The advice given on this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended as investment advice. Please consult a financial advisor before undertaking any investment decisions. While the show's producers have tried to provide accurate and timely information and have relied on sources they believe to be reliable, the show may include inadvertent technical or factual inaccuracies. Jack Monteith and Ken Smith do not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the materials provided and expressly disclaim any warranties or merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose.
Hello, I'm Ken Smith, CEO of Empirical Wealth Management and co-host of financial radio program, Successful Investing Radio. What you're about to hear is a full-length interview I conducted with multi-book author and director of research at BAM Advisor Services, Larry Swedreau. Portions of this interview have aired on our Successful Investing Radio program, and to listen to this interview and other interviews online, you can visit our website at www.successfulinvestingradio.com. To find out how Empirical Wealth Management can help you achieve your financial objectives, please give us a call at 1-800-923-4307 or visit our website at www.empiricalwm.com. Empirical is spelled E-M-P-I-R-I-C-A-L. We invite you to engage us in a discovery process as a step toward making smart financial decisions. Larry Swedreau is here to talk about his latest book titled The Only Guide to an Alternative Investment Strategy You'll Ever Need, The Good, The Flawed, The Bad, and The Ugly. This book rounds out a trilogy of investment guidebooks he's written. The two predecessors are The Only Guide to a Winning Investment Strategy You'll Ever Need, and the second is The Only Guide to a Winning Bond Strategy You'll Ever Need. He's written several other investment books as well, and I would encourage you to check out all of Larry's books, as I have found them to be some of the most relevant and useful investment books in publication. We begin our discussion with Larry answering my questions on the current market environment and his advice for investors today who are facing an abundance of frightening market and economic news. We then move on to discuss various investment strategies covered in his recent book. I hope you find this interview enlightening. Thank you for listening, and please contact us with questions or comments. And Larry, before we get into the discussion about your book and alternative investments, I think we should take a moment to talk about what's going on in the current market environment and what you believe investors should be doing today. You know, in our practice, we've spent a lot of time communicating with clients, revisiting their asset allocation to make sure that the mix of stocks and bonds and the diversification that we put into place still makes sense to them, not because the market's down, but because their circumstances continue to dictate that they're in the appropriate mix. My fear is that there are a lot of listeners out there who may not be working with a financial advisor, or they are working with one, but that advisor may not be taking the passive, diversified asset allocated approach that we recommend, maybe timing in and out of markets. And these listeners may be inclined to make emotional decisions that may not be in their best interest over the long run.
Oh, we know that that's true. The studies on investor behavior, if you will, are very clear that investors' worst enemy is themselves. A study by Vanguard, for example, examined what are called the time-weighted returns reported by mutual funds. That's a return that's calculated as if you put a dollar in day one and then simply reinvest dividends over time. That's the return the fund provides its investors if they stay the course the entire time. But that's, of course, not how most investors invest. They may add new money over time. If you're in withdrawal phase, you're taking out. And, of course, investors often jump from one fund to another, typically buying after periods of good performance and selling after periods of bad performance. And the study by Vanguard found that in the case of every mutual fund family except one, the time-weighted returns reported by the funds were higher than the dollar-weighted returns that investors actually earned investing in those funds because they, you know, panic and sell during bear markets and they get too greedy and enthusiastic and buy, you know, after periods of great performance. So Vanguard then did a very interesting further study. They looked at the time-weighted and dollar-weighted returns of index funds, which you would think would be more passive investors. Mm-hmm. But of course, just because you invest in index fund doesn't mean you're passive. You could jump from a small cap index to an emerging market index because you think that's the place to be now, or you can go to cash. What they found is that the time-weighted returns reported by the mutual funds were 9%, and the dollar-weighted returns earned by investors in those very same funds was 7%. So investors were costing themselves 2% a year by their very actions. There was actually only one fund family in the entire universe they found where that was not true. And in fact, the dollar-weighted returns earned by investors were higher than the time-weighted returns reported by the funds. And that was the case for the funds of dimensional fund advisors. And that's easily explained because Dimensional requires investors to use an advisor who is getting the investor to act like a postage stamp, sticking or adhering to their plan until they reach their destination. And that means rebalancing the portfolio, which means buying low after periods of poor performance and selling high after periods of good performance. So it's a clear example how a good advisor can add value by simply keeping an investor adhering to a well-thought-out plan.
That's entirely true, and I want to follow up on that. As long as we're on that question, Larry, if that is the case, and you so eloquently explained in our last interview that the market is a zero-sum game, and Eugene Fama has talked about that in his papers, who is winning then? Who's picking up the returns that those investors are leaving on the table?
Well, in general, those returns are, if you will, evaporating out of the pockets from investors and going into the pockets of the purveyors of these mutual funds and market makers who make money every time somebody trades. Every time you trade, Schwab or Fidelity or some brokerage firm is collecting fees. They have the croupier at the table. Using a Las Vegas term, or you're paying big fees, you know, obviously to investors, investment managers, in transactions costs as well, and so you underperform indices. So that's the problem: is investors are missing out on the returns because often they have these expenses, but often they're out of the market. Okay. When the stock market is actually rallying, because it tends to do well after periods of bad performance because valuations are low. And, of course, you have higher expected returns after bear markets.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, here's some interesting statistics, Ken, that I'm sure your listeners would be amazed at, perhaps. When the unemployment rate is over 6%, and things look gloomy like they look today, the returns to the S&P 500 since 1950 are 15%, or roughly 50% higher than the long-term average return of 10%. On the other hand, when everything looks great and unemployment is under 4.3, we might consider that sort of almost full employment, the returns to stocks are less than or right around 2%. Which is not much better than probably than an interest-bearing checking account. And the problem is investors' vision is, you will, gets clouded by the fact of all the bad news around them, reported by the press and the media, their friends getting unemployed or whatever. And they forget that the unemployment rate is a lagging indicator of the economy, while the stock market is a leading indicator.
Well, let's go down that line, Larry. Then what do you think investors should be doing today?
Well, they should be doing the same thing that they should always have been doing, which is, first of all, they should have a well-thought-out plan that incorporates their ability, willingness, and need to take risks, so to make sure that they can handle the risks that show up. That plan must incorporate the fact that we're going to have major crises like we're having now from time to time. Just since 1970, we've had many crises, so they should be in investors' memory. In 1970, we had a AAA commercial paper credit fail, and the whole commercial paper market seized up. There was no market at all. That company was called Penn Central. In 73-4, of course, we had the oil embargo and the terrible recession that followed that. Stocks dropped 50%. In 1981, we had interest rates above 20%, unemployment around 10%, terrible recession. Then in 1989, we had the S&L crisis, okay, when over 1,000 banks failed, led by a junk bond crisis. And now we have a subprime crisis. Then it was junk bonds and Michael Milken. I skipped over, actually, a 1983 crisis. When almost every major multinational U.S. bank was either technically bankrupt or on the verge of it. Continental Illinois and the Bank of New England, two of the largest banks in the country, actually failed, and Citicorp was on the verge of bankruptcy, saved only by a sheik of Saudi Arabia injecting billions to bail them out. 91, of course, we had the not only a bad recession, but we had the Kuwaiti War. 98, we had a terrible crisis known as the Asian contagion, when long-term capital, the largest hedge fund in the world, you know, failed, and the central bank had to organize a rescue because they were afraid of systemic risks being transferred around the globe and banks failing. We had major emerging market countries default on their debt, including Russia and Argentina. Malaysia cut their shut their currency markets. And then, of course, we had 2001 and the events that followed the September 11th and the terrible recession. Stocks again fell 50%. So we've had many, many crises, and they certainly should be in people's memories, and yet they tend to panic and sell when these things occur. And, of course, the only way you got the great returns is if you had faith in the capital system and stayed the course.
So, Larry, I think what you're saying is that the crisis is a part of being invested in the market.
Absolutely. In fact, one of my favorite expressions is the only thing about investing you don't know is the investment history you don't know. You must build these crises into your plan, and forewarned is forearmed, and anticipating them helps you understand that we're almost certainly, although it's not a guarantee, we'll get through this. And while this is the worst crisis probably in the post-war era, we're also taking unprecedented actions to correct it. And unlike the failure of the government in the U.S. in the 1930s, when they actually raised interest rates to fight the speculation at the time, and Hoover raised taxes, and Japan also did not act swiftly or sufficiently to correct their problem, and that's why they went into an almost 20-year type recession. And here we have massive effort, not only by the central bank in the U.S. flooding the markets with liquidity in unprecedented amounts, massive fiscal efforts, but we're getting that coordinated efforts all around the globe, probably for the first time ever. And, you know, the investors are making the mistake of not seeing through that. And if the market, the economies continue to weaken, we will almost certainly see more efforts, more fiscal stimulus, and more monetary stimulus in the form of further rate cuts. So unless you're planning for the end of the world, and I don't suggest that's productive because, first of all, it'll only happen once, and second of all, you'll be dead anyway, I think you have to have a faith in the capitalist system, and we will likely come out of this.
Well, not to beat a dead horse here, Larry, but I think this is something that people are thinking about right now. So I want to ask you this. Is there any condition, any piece of economic news that could come out or market news that could come out that would change your view and say, you know what, maybe we need to reduce our allocation to equities? Even for someone who did the appropriate, every client we work with takes a thorough risk tolerance, risk capacity assessment that we put them through, and we look at all their big picture goals and everything. So say we've done that planning and now they're in the right allocation. Is there anything that could happen where you would say, hey, let's deviate from this plan and reduce our exposure?
Well, I can't think of anything directly that would do that. And one of the main reasons is once it happens, the market will instantly react and adjust prices, so it's too late to do anything about it unless you could have forecasted that event. And obviously, if you could forecast it, then the market would already incorporate that price. That's the problem here. But, you know, if we, say, abandon our capitalist system and become a socialist or, you know, country or a Marxist country or communist or whatever words people want to use, then that would make me rethink, you know, my view of the world. But I can't see that happening.
And there's no level of the market declining that would shake you from these principles either, then?
No. In fact, the worse the market gets, the better the future expected returns are. The historical evidence is very clear. There's a direct correlation. The lower the PEs are, the higher the future returns, you know, go. And, you know, that's another thing that people fail to understand. We're at very, very low levels historically, especially outside the U.S., for valuations. Emerging markets are trading in single digits now. So are the large cap stocks of the non-U.S. developed world, Europe, Australia, Japan, etc., all trading in single digits. These are levels that are well below historical averages. And typically we only get to these kinds of levels of low P.E. ratios when you have extremely high interest rates like we had in 1981. I can't vouch for the data because I haven't seen it myself, but I did read that an article that was saying that even in the Great Depression, we didn't have really single-digit P.E. ratios because the market was ultimately anticipating that earnings would recover. Just the long-term historical average for the S&P 500 is about 15 price-earnings ratio, and we're well below that. I mean, prices are down 40% now, and I don't think anyone believes we've seen a permanent 40% reduction in earnings.
Right.
And that's really what is being priced now.
Larry, are you using, when you look at P/E ratios, because I've seen, read some of the material, different academics like Robert Shiller talks about using a 10-year moving average to calculate P/E, what real P/E ratios are, and if you use that you get a higher, we're still valued higher than what we're looking at if we're just using a 12-month trailing average. What do you have any view on that?
I'm not a huge fan of that context because markets should be forward-looking.
Okay.
But I understand the principle behind it. But right now, with the collapse of prices, and remember now earnings are going to be below their longer-term average, I think that even that indicator is probably, you know, within, you know, a normal framework now, and stocks are starting to look relatively cheap. And you also have to remember that, you know, stocks compete with alternatives, and that alternative is a risk-free benchmark of the one-month Treasury bill, and that rate is zero now.
Right.
So stocks can support higher valuations when they compete with a zero risk-free rate than when they're competing, say, with the historical average of a closer to, you know, 3 or 4% for the one-month Treasury.
Well, that makes sense. I think it's very confusing for people, Larry, because if you turn on the TV, and I turned on, I was watching one of the news networks last night, and they had two of the CNBC correspondents on there, and they were talking about how, hey, things are going to get a lot worse. And what is your advice, just to tune that out?
I would say without question investors should turn off CNBC, stop reading all the financial press, because it is basically what I call investment pornography. It has no value whatsoever, and in fact it has negative value because it's only likely to cause your stomach to react, and your stomach doesn't make good investment decisions. You want to make decisions with your head. And when your stomach's acting up, it's causing you to think that you need to do something, just do anything, when doing something may be in your worst interest, and that's what the historical evidence shows. For those people who believe that these talking heads in the media know where the market's going, I would just urge them to read a wonderful book by William Sherndon called The Fortune Sellers, And he showed categorically that there were no forecasters who had any good track records. Even the experts, including those who can influence economic policy and influence then the outcome, those at the Federal Reserve, the Congressional Budget Office, and the Council of Economic Advisers, had worse forecasting records than monkeys throwing darts.
Gotcha. Well, that's great advice, and I just to finish up on this topic, for those who are retired already, I know that they are particularly concerned when they see their portfolio decline. And I guess my view is, what are the options if they move out of stocks, having any stocks in their portfolio at all, to cash or CDs, and we're going to lead into your book and talk about annuities and those other structured products that are out there that are offering principal protection. But what do they have to go to that's, you know, if they abandon their strategy now, and is that a wise thing to do?
Well, I think you have to go back to our original premise, which is you shouldn't take more risks than you have the ability, willingness, or need to take. And obviously, those who are in the withdrawal stage have much less ability to take risk, because if once you withdraw money, you can never recover because you've spent it. Someone who's 25 years old can wait out a bear market and stay with it and keep investing, and ultimately they will have been rewarded. But, you know, that doesn't work if you're in retirement. So
Right. That,
you know, means that those people should have much lower equity allocations in the first place. And unfortunately, too many retirees end up with too aggressive portfolios because they don't understand the nature of risk. They get too optimistic. They forget don't know their financial history and understand how devastating bear markets can be to portfolios that are in the withdrawal stage. So that's absolutely critical. And if somebody made that mistake, you know, I have one of my favorite expressions is this: even smart people make mistakes, but only fools repeat or perpetuate them once you learn it's a mistake. So if you're in retirement and you've took too much risk, well, that's unfortunate that you made a mistake, but not altering your portfolio allocation today would be an even worse mistake, because that would be perpetuating the error. You need to recognize you made the error. Just make sure it's your head making that decision and not your stomach reacting to the noise. But if it was an error of the head, then I think you need to adjust your allocation. It may also mean you have to adjust your lifestyle. It may mean, you know, you have to give up traveling or cut expenses or move to a lower cost area. But that's far better than, you know, burying your head in the sand, because your portfolio will likely blow up, if you will, and you'll be alive with no money, and there's nothing worse I can think of than that.
Yeah.
So, again, I would go back and say, make sure your plan is right. Make sure it incorporates bear markets. Make sure it incorporates the fact that this market could get a lot worse, and maybe we're the next Japan, where markets don't recover for 20 years. That's possible. I don't think it's likely, but I don't rule it out.
Right. Well, let's talk about your recent book, and it's The Only Guide to Alternative Investments You'll Ever Need: The Good, the Flawed, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I love that name, Larry. And this book is coming out this month, right? Is it out?
It's actually out now. Just hit the store shelves, and I know Amazon's had it out for about a week or so.
Oh, great. And you were kind enough to send me a copy in advance, and I read it, and it was great. Let's start with why should someone pick up this book? What are they going to learn?
There are a few things. The book has got the subtitle, as you mentioned, The Good, the Flawed, the Bad, and the Ugly. You'll learn that there are, of the myriad alternative investments that you have, there's only a handful that you really should even consider for part of your portfolio. And the two that I think almost every investor should have are tips, and at least for the elderly in their retirement, they should at least consider fixed or what are called payout annuities. But all of the rest of the other products, and I cover 20 of them in total in the book, the other 14 that are in The Flawed, the Bad, and the Ugly are not only not needed, in most cases there's either a better way to try and achieve higher returns or higher risk-adjusted returns, or these products should simply be avoided because they only enrich the purveyors of the product, not the not likely to enrich the people who invest in it.
And would you mind if we mentioned a few of those?
No, go right ahead.
Let's go to the bad and the ugly. You mentioned in the bad, hedge funds, leveraged buyouts, variable annuities. The ugly, equity indexed annuities, structured investment products, and leveraged funds. And I think most people are probably, if not familiar, have become more familiar recently with hedge funds. And maybe you could talk a little bit about why they are in the bad section.
Well, I'll give you just my sort of one-liner soundbite type of answer is, if you want to give your money to somebody who invests it in a way that they don't tell you what they're going to do with it, put it into highly risky securities, you take 100% of the risk and get less than 80% of the return in a highly tax-inefficient manner. And the academic evidence shows that hedge funds have a hard time keeping up with the risk-adjusted returns of treasury bills, be my guest.
Gotcha.
These things are products that should be avoided at almost all costs.
So,
they're only likely to enrich the purveyors, not the people who invest in them.
Certainly someone has done well in them, because how do you explain the large amount of assets?
Well, you can fool a lot of the people all of the time is one of my expressions. That's one thing. A lot of people invest in the hedge funds basically because of their egos are big. They want to be members of the club, if you will, have that great story to tell at the country club that I invested in Morgan Stanley or Citicorp or whatever, great hedge fund. And yeah, there are a few great success stories. But, you know, the problem is we can't identify them in advance. That's what the academic literature shows. These things are like lottery tickets. There are a few big winners, and there's no persistence of performance beyond what we would randomly expect. The data is so bad. Consider this. In the 5 great years of the stock market that we experienced from 2003 to 2007, when the 10 equity asset classes I listed in my book, from the S&P 500 to small stocks and value stocks and real estate and emerging markets and, you know, EFI, you know, developed market stocks, those returns range from about 13% to 38%. The hedge fund index earned less than half of the worst asset class. They earned 6.4%, which was only 0.1% better than the return on totally riskless tips, which returned 6.3%. And this year, when these funds that are called absolute return funds, meaning they're supposed to provide positive returns in any environment, they're down something on the order of 15 or 20% this year. So they certainly didn't protect you from bear markets. And while better than, you know, the equity market returns, this, again, much worse than tips. So you would have been far better off if, instead of buying hedge funds, just simply combined equity risks with an appropriate amount of tips in your portfolio, and you'd be way ahead than if you had invested in hedge funds.
Got it. Well, in the categories, the flawed, the bad, the ugly, and I'm gonna ask you here if I'm on the right track. But it seems like when I look at these asset class, the securities in there, high yield bonds, covered call writing, precious metals, and then we talk about hedge funds and structured investments, that the appeal is at the surface to an average investor would be either a higher rate of return or somehow a protection of risk from the stock market. And then you talk about, well, knowing what an expected return, you need to know that. You also need to have an idea what the risk should be, but there's more to it than even that. Could you expand on that a little bit, or explain?
Yeah, it's very important that you not only look at the risk and the expected return of the investment, but a major mistake that not only individual investors make, but professional advisors, I find, make, is they consider the risk and return of an asset class in isolation, when what you want to look at is the risk and return of an asset class when you add that asset class to the portfolio, how its addition impacts the overall risk of the portfolio. Some asset classes mix very well with the other components in the portfolio. Commodities in the form of fully collateralized commodity futures is an example, because commodities in general tend to, although not always, have their best years when stocks and bonds are doing very poorly. Not always, but generally that's true, and I show that evidence in my book. But there are other asset classes that mix very poorly with the rest of the portfolio because their risks tend to show up at the same time that stocks and bonds may be doing poorly. So, for example, you know, let's say you're 60% stocks and 40% bonds as your asset allocation, and some investment advisor advises you, well, we diversify our equity risk to include small and value and real estate and emerging markets, etc. We should diversify our fixed income investments to low correlating asset classes like preferred stocks, emerging market bonds, high yield bonds, and maybe in our 40% we'll keep 10% in, say, treasury bonds, and then put 10% in each of these high yield bonds, emerging market bonds, and preferred stocks, okay? Well, the problem is that those people who make that recommendation fail to understand that these types of instruments are all risky investments that have equity-like risks, and they tend to do poorly, and their risks show up at just the time you need them to be safe when your stocks are getting hit. So, for example, this year, obviously, stocks are getting hammered, and investors' portfolios are being devastated, so you'd want that safety part of your portfolio to at least be holding its own, if not appreciating, and that's been true of treasury investments. They've actually gone up this year. On the other hand, if you invested in even Vanguard's high yield fund, which isn't quite in the junk category, it's down 22%. Just when you need the safety, it's dragging you down. A true junk bond fund would be down even worse. Emerging market bond funds, last time I checked, were down close to 30%. Preferred stocks are down 25-30%. Convertible bonds have gotten slaughtered, and a lot of hedge funds have blown up over their big losses. So it's a big problem. It's a failure of the to understand that you need not only to look at correlations even, that's not sufficient, but you need to understand when the correlations tend to turn low and when they tend to turn high. So you have to look at that and, of course, costs and tax efficiency as well.
Well, do you find that I've experienced that investors, when they get to the fixed income portion of, or even when they're right now, we were just doing a workshop and a couple of attendees were asking, hey, should we be looking at higher dividend yielding stocks? Or when they're looking at their fixed income, they're looking at the current yields. Do you find that there's a flaw in that?
Yeah, there is actually, people should know better than that. Because a study was done in the 1950s by fellows Modigliani and Miller that showed dividend payments are irrelevant to the cost of capital of a firm, and the flip side of a cost of capital to a company is the return of investors, or at least the expected return. So, you know, dividends, you know, can often be an illusion. They're there, and you buy a high dividend yield, but that means you're buying a highly risky stock, of course. Or the dividend yield wouldn't be high. So, to me, that's not really a good way necessarily to invest. The academic evidence is that the better way to diversify your portfolio is to use other value metrics like book-to-market value. But, you know, again, if you buy value stocks, these high book-to-market value companies, you are taking more risks. So you have to be careful whether you're buying high dividend stocks or stocks that are low-priced value companies. Recognize that there's risk in that. It's not a free lunch.
I think there's this view that there's safety with higher current yields.
Yeah, well, people who, you know, buying, for example, GM and Ford for their high yields, and a lot of other companies are finding those dividends are going to get slashed. But I will add this. Higher dividend-yielding stocks have historically provided higher returns. But that means you're taking more risk. Don't think it's a free lunch.
Exactly. Well, I want to talk about, you know, in the good section, you have real estate in that category. And given what's gone on with the housing market, you know, what's being called a bubble and now the collapse of that bubble, is that still a good area for people to be invested in? And if you wouldn't mind talking about how you recommend people
get
exposure.
It's a great question. Real estate is an alternative to what I think of as in generally equity investments in general, or stocks. REITs are equity investments, but specialize in real estate investment trusts. And they are a unique asset class. It has very low correlation with their returns of equities. However, because they are equity risks of some kind, that means that when you have times of crises, the risks will tend to correlate highly. So there are times when stocks get killed and your real estate will also get killed. We're in one of those times now. That isn't always the case. In 2002, if my memory serves, when in general U.S. stocks and international stocks were getting hit, real estate did quite well. But there is that risk that they can have high correlation at the wrong time, particularly in liquidity crises, because real estate investments rely on leverage, of course. So that's why it's so important that while real estate is a very good diversifier over the long term, in the short term, it can act like equities, and that's why you must make sure your portfolio has the right amount of very high-quality fixed income investments, meaning U.S. Treasuries or AAA-rated municipal bonds, to dampen the overall risk of the portfolio to a level that does not exceed your ability, willingness, or need to take. So diversification works with equities. It's just that you have to make sure that your portfolio can withstand periods when all equities are doing poorly, because there will be those times. We've seen them many times in the past, and we'll see them again.
Larry, when it comes to real estate being primary residence, I think this is a confusing issue for investors. And it's how you have an investor, two investors that have the same net worth. One has put 50% of their net worth into their home, and they may or may not encumber that property. And one has just chooses to have a smaller amount of their net worth, say it's only 25% in their home, and they may or may not encumber it with a loan. How does that affect the asset allocation decisions to the other asset classes that we talk about, stocks, bonds, REITs?
Great question. It's one addressed very specifically and in great detail in the book. It talks about how do you deal with your home. Before I get there, I want to make sure I answer your other question, which I missed up on. Which is that the way to invest in real estate, I think there's only one prudent way to do that, and then that's basically invest in an index fund of REITs. Vanguard has a very good fund. There's an ETF, and Dimensional Fund Advisors also has a very good REIT fund, which is passively managed. That way you're diversifying broadly across the whole asset class of REITs, so you're buying into hotels and office space and warehouses and apartments, etc., and you're geographically diversified. That way you eliminate the unique risk of owning one particular property in an area or one particular type of investment like your home. So that partly addresses your question. You can have real estate performing very well as an asset class, but your particular property is in an area where home prices are collapsing. That's not going to be effective diversification. The good example or analogy to that is thinking you've got all your money in one stock, let's say Bear Stearns, and thinking you're invested in equities. Yeah, you've got one, but your returns are going to look nothing like the market returns in all likelihood. Could be much better. It could be much worse. But you're taking what we would call undiversified risk, which you shouldn't get compensated for because you can diversify it away. Coming back specifically to the home, a few things. One, a home should never be treated as an investment. It should be treated as a consumption item. In the long history of the U.S., up until the 60s, homes provided basically a zero real rate of return. That's important. We just, you know, had a, I would think, a lucky period where homes tend to do well in certain areas of the country, and but not others. And so I think homes should not be treated as investments. They should be treated as an asset on your balance sheet that may be used as a store of value, and someday you may be able to access that capital should you sell it. But it's not an asset in the way equities are. There's lots of things you can do with equities you cannot do with a home. You can't rebalance. You can't tax manage it. So I would treat it totally independently. And again, of course, it's not diversified. So even if you have a home, I would not consider that even exposure to the asset class of real estate, and I'd still want to consider owning an exposure to real estate if I had room in a tax-advantaged account. Then the other thing related to a home, which most people miss on, is that if you have a mortgage, that's really what I would call negative fixed income. So if you own, say, $100,000 of bonds and you have $100,000 of mortgage is debt, then you really have zero exposure to fixed income investments. You don't have, $100,000 exposure. So what I mean by that is this. If you have $100,000 in stocks, $100,000 in bonds, and you think you're 50-50, mm-hmm. your asset allocation, but if you also have a mortgage of $100,000, you're 100% invested in stocks because you have no exposure to fixed income investments net.
So you would want to potentially adjust your allocation then to reflect that.
Right, but you also need to take into account whether your mortgage is fixed income or a fixed rate mortgage or an adjustable rate mortgage, and what types of income generating assets you hold. Are they short-term or long-term? And those assets can, be different versus the liability mix. So that should be considered as well. But it's a big mistake that most people make is not counting the mortgage as a negative exposure to fixed income.
Got it. Well, Larry, I want to ask about one more asset class and then just, and your time's valuable, then open it up if there's anything else you want to share. But you mentioned fixed annuities in your book, which I probably wouldn't have thought of as an alternative investment, but it's in that in there, and you mentioned that in cases you think it's an appropriate investment. And I know with the market going down, I think I had read some data that there's been quite a large amount of money been moving towards fixed annuities. Would you talk a little bit about when they're appropriate? And
right. Well, I think fixed annuities now, as they're constructed generally now, are a very good product for people to consider. However, they generally should not be bought until you're in your mid-70s. And the reason is that they are good is they contain what are called mortality credits. What that means is this. If, you have 10 people who are age 75, let's say, and they each invest $1,000, and you get, CD rates are at 5%, so you get $50 back at the end of the year in interest, the group as a whole gets $50,500, and at the end of the year, everyone would get back, $5,500. Everyone would get back their $1,050 in interest for a total of $1,050. However, if the group agrees that they will pool their money and only the people who are alive at the end of the year will collect and share the pool, then since we might know, say, for example, using actuarial tables, that we could expect 1 in 10 to die, then the other 9 would share the pool of 1,000 and of 5,500, the expected return would jump to something like 16 or 17%. And insurance companies know very well what the odds are people are living and dying in any one year, so they can create actuarial tables. And those are mortality credits are given to individuals and boost the yield. So you can get very high returns. If you buy them in your mid-80s, it's almost impossible for stocks to have higher expected returns because the mortality credits are so great.
Gotcha.
The problem is if you buy them early in your life, then the mortality credits are very small because most people you know, are going to live, and you have to overcome, in addition, the cost of the insurance company to produce, market, and service those contracts. So until you get to the mid-70s, the mortality credits are not sufficient to offset the cost of the product. Once you get there, they become attractive, and they are, in effect, act as longevity insurance. You know, we insure against lots of things in our life, a life early death, for example, homeowners insurance, flood insurance, earthquake insurance,
right,
disability insurance, and too many people fail to think about buying longevity insurance because they don't think of that as a risk. But obviously you can outlive your money if you're not careful, and this is one way to insure against that, is by buying longevity insurance in the form of a fixed annuity.
Would you consider interest rates at the time you're purchasing? Would that be a consideration at all?
Absolutely, but it doesn't. It's one of the risks of buying annuities, is if you delay buying them, then there's a risk that interest rates will go down, and then of course the insurance company will pay you less each year for the same investment. If interest rates go up, then of course they'll be able to pay you more. So one way to deal with that is to diversify that risk over time. So once you hit maybe age 70, you start buying, maybe up $50,000 every year. And so you're diversifying over time the risk of interest rates moving. And of course, because you're hopefully going to be collecting for a long time, you want to make sure you buy it only from, in my mind, a AAA-rated insurance company.
That was going to be my next question, is how to... are all issuers alike?
No, and actually you can take a little bit of risk with a small amount because state agencies guarantee in most states, and you should check your own state,
okay,
a guarantee annuity products. In most cases, it's at 100,000 level. In some states, it's higher. I think one state goes at least 500,000. So it sort of acts like FDIC insurance. But once you're over that limit, I'd certainly want to have a AAA credit, or I wouldn't buy it.
Got it. Well, Larry, there's a lot in this book, and I recommend all our listeners pick it up, especially if they're tempted as a result of the current market environment to be looking for alternatives. And I think that's something that, and you can speak to that in your research, is that when we have tough market times, people start searching for alternative investments more than they do so in other times?
I think it's, number one, it's tough markets like this, although they're seeing how badly hedge funds, for example, and venture capital is performing, you know, during these markets. And by the way, we didn't touch on them, but venture capital, I put that in the flawed category because they've actually provided equity-like returns, but you take a lot more risk, including liquidity. You tie money up for 10 years. And if you want to seek out higher returns, just invest in a small value index fund. You would have dramatically outperformed the average venture capital firm, dramatically. And you don't have any of those liquidity issues. But the other time is not just when markets are doing poorly, it's when interest rates are very low. Then people, particularly retirees, think, I've got to try to get a higher yield, and they end up taking lots of risk investing in things like preferred stocks and emerging market bonds and high yield or junk bonds, and those are really, in my mind, investments that should be avoided. There are better ways, if you need to get higher returns or higher expected returns, to achieve that.
And you wrote a great paper that I read about, was it reverse?
Reverse convertibles,
yeah.
I'll make a general comment about this whole category of what I call structured notes. And I would say it this way. As professional investors know, the surest way to create a small fortune is to start out with a large one and make interesting or exciting investments. You know, sophisticated investors never make investments without fully investigating the risks. If you can't explain the product to a 10-year-old child, you probably shouldn't invest in it yourself. And some investments are just so complex in design that it's difficult, if not impossible, for the average individual investor to fully understand the risks. I call them tourist traps. And what's key is this. If a product looks like it's high yield, a high return. It is very risky, even if you can't see the risks. Okay, that's why so many of these products are what I would call, they're truly tourist traps. They're designed to be sold, not bought. And you have to remember this, when a sophisticated financial institution that designs these alternative investments and they send their marketing machines to square off against the average individual investor, it's the equivalent of the New England Patriots playing against some Sandlot football team. You know who's going to win that
game.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's just not a fair contest. You know, and the last thing I would say about this is, when they offer products that, like reverse convertibles you mentioned, that offer very high yields, you should ask yourself this question. Who are the issuers of these products? They're very sophisticated financial institutions like Morgan Stanley. They don't play Santa Claus and give additional returns to investors. They issue them because they know that this is likely to be a cheaper source of capital for them. And that means investors in the end will see lower returns. Investors just can't see the risk.
It seems to me, Larry, and correct me if I'm wrong, that these firms, and we've seen some of them go out of business here recently,
right,
make more money selling these types of products to investors than they do actually running and picking their own investments.
Well, we know that that's true. And, you know, all of the evidence, and I presented in all of my books, shows that the right strategy for investors, the one most likely to enable them to achieve their goals, is to be a passive buy and hold rebalance investor using very low cost tax efficient funds like index funds, and then simply stay the course. That's the winning strategy for them. And if you ever thought that Wall Street was on your side and they could manage your money and your risk better than you could, or a good advisor who's an independent registered investment advisor who has a fiduciary responsibility like you and I do, then all you have to do is look at their own performance. They can't even manage their own risks.
Right.
Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns blew up, Goldman and Morgan Stanley are in danger of blowing up. Why anyone would trust them to manage money is beyond me.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. It also amazes me that, you know, with all the litigation, as many times as they get caught abusing consumers and it gets reported, that they still have business. I don't understand that.
Well, like I said, and I'm not original. You can fool all of the people some of the time, and you can fool some of the people all of the time.
Yeah.
And that's why I wrote my books, is really to educate people, give them the knowledge they need to finally make an informed decision, because Wall Street and the media are not going to tell you what the prudent strategy is, because it's not in their interest. They need you to believe in this active management. It's exciting. They need you to tune in. You know, as Benjamin Franklin said, an investment in knowledge pays the best interest. So, you know, I tell people, you want to learn the right strategy, pick up books like mine.
And would you mind, Larry, at this point, just sharing all the different books you have, the resources, websites, services that they can connect
to? Sure, obviously. I've written a trilogy of only guides. The first was called The Only Guide to Winning Investment Strategy You'll Ever Need. And when it first came out, the Wall Street Journal called it one of the three best investment books that year. I follow that up with The Only Guide to a Winning Bond Strategy You'll Ever Need, so that covers fixed incomes. And this is the completion of my trilogy, The Only Guide to Alternative Investments You'll Ever Need. I also wrote a book on behavioral finance called Rational Investing in Irrational Times. It covers 52 mistakes that investors make. I have another book called The Successful Investor Today, 14 Simple Truths You Need to Know About Investing. And finally, I wrote a book that's really meant for the less sophisticated investor, although I think even the most sophisticated investors will enjoy it. But it's a collection of stories called Wise Investing Made Simple, 27 short stories that anyone can understand, using analogies to cooking and sports and history that help make these difficult concepts surrounding modern portfolio theory and efficient markets very easy for any intelligent person to understand, even as long as you know what a stock and a bond is. If you don't know that, then first you need to pick up books like Stocks for Dummies.
Yeah, yeah.
My firm has a website. It's BAM, B-A-M, Services. That stands for Buckingham Asset Management. So BAMServices.com, so you can learn more about my books and how we manage money.
That's great, Larry. And thank you very much for coming on our show again.
My pleasure, Ken. Glad to come back anytime. It's sort of my way of giving something back.